This is the 2011 West Coast School of the Prophets. Our theme for the weekend is The Day of the Lord Draweth Nigh. Our speaker is Brother Carl Perry from the Salisbury Ecclesia in Adelaide, Australia. This is session number 9, entitled, I Will Be Whom I Will Be. And the reading was Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15. Brother Carl.
Okay, thanks, Brother Tony. Well, we now need to switch gears and move from current events back into the desert of Sinai, Exodus chapter 3. We left our last consideration of Moses lamenting the fact in Psalm 90 that God had forgotten him. God's wrath was consuming him, that his anger was waxed hot against him. And Moses, in speaking those words, is really coming to the conclusion that 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20, 25, 30, 35 years, God has still not come. Therefore, his anger is great against them. And the presumption that Moses demonstrated by attempting to bring Israel out of Egypt was, in fact, the object of God's wrath. But now, 40 years after Moses first came, Exodus chapter 3, verse 1 says this. Now, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. Now, what's that saying? Several things. For a prince and a man mighty in word and in deed, in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, to end up looking after sheep in the desert would be one of the most humbling and possibly humiliating experiences that one could ever experience. From the courts of Pharaoh, the decision-making, the international diplomacy, all of that tremendous sense of statesmanship, to now just moving around desert places looking for pasture for some sheep and goats in the desert. A huge change. And for people who didn't have a spiritual kind of perception or a spiritual depth about it, it would have been so humiliating that it probably would have said, well, if that's the way God treats me, forget it. But not Moses. Because the record says that he kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. Now, why should the record say that? Because he understood that his father-in-law, being a priest of Midian, offered him a number of advantages that Egypt could never give. And we saw those briefly in the last session. Sacrifice, mediatorship, holiness, caring, compassion, all of those things associated with the priesthood in which Jethro of Midian was involved in. Now, I don't know, I could not take 40 years, and I've been to Mount Sinai, I could not take, I don't think, 40 years wandering around that kind of environment looking after sheep and goats. But you see, despite the searing heat and the drought and the storms and the hardship of that, God was teaching him enormous lessons. And we're going to see he is a changed man, a dramatically changed man. Keeping of sheep, let's come to Numbers chapter 27, because the care of God's people is precisely that, shepherding. Numbers 27. Verse 15. And Moses spake unto Yahweh, saying, Let Yahweh, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation. Verse 17. Which may go out before them, which may go in before them, which may lead them out, which may bring them in, that the congregation of Yahweh be not as sheep which have no shepherd. Now, young brethren, I'd imagine that quite a few of you here are involved in young people's activities. You're probably moving through ecclesial life, giving perhaps more addresses, leading things in ecclesial life, taking more responsibility in ecclesial life. And that's a good thing. One of the things we've got to get through to all of us, myself included, is that work is a work of shepherding. It's not the promotion of self. It's not an ego trip. It's not designed to make us have an increased status in ecclesial life. None of that at all. It is a work of shepherding. And if you can see your work in that light, it is a valuable perception to have. Because you see, shepherding involves not only leading the healthy to good pasture, but those who are struggling to good pasture as well. And it's the strugglers and the people who sort of are not quite sure. It's the young people in your ecclesia who are sort of on the edge. Those are the people you really need to nurture. And the shepherd spends time doing that. Doesn't leave the others unfed, but it's this not only just caring about people, but having the capacity to give them the word of God exactly as they need it. Some young people require this approach to the word of God, and other young people require this kind of approach. You've got to have the skills to be able to give them the right pasture, the right amounts at the right time to get them into that fold. And that's exactly what Moses had to learn. It's all very well being great and mighty in Egypt. In the end, God said, 40 years later, you're now ready to look after my people. That is a huge lesson. And you know, sometimes the knocks of life and the experiences and difficulties of life give us that experience to have an empathy with people who we're helping. We're not shepherds over the flock. We're ensamples among the flock. That was Peter's words in his epistle. We lead by example, we lead by caring, we lead by shepherding. And that really is a critical lesson that we have to learn. And Moses learned that as well, 40 years in that wilderness to learn that lesson. And there was a dramatic change in him. Like Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And I've learned that in whatsoever circumstances that God puts me in, to be content therewith. And Moses learned that. Shepherding is an exceedingly important work in ecclesial life. The great leaders of Israel were shepherds. The Abrahams, the Isaacs, the Jacobs, the Davids, the Moses were shepherds. Because that's the quality. I found David a shepherd, a man after my own heart, who gathered the young. Look at Isaiah 40. It's the work of Messiah himself. This is why it's so important to cultivate this caring, feeding, protecting kind of work amongst your young people, amongst the brethren and sisters that you work amongst. Now look at the contrast here. Isaiah 40, talking about John the Baptist introducing Jesus Christ. In verse 10, behold, the Lord Yahweh will come with strong hand. His arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, his work before him. So we have the picture here of a man with a strong arm ruling. But in verse 11, he shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and shall gently lead those that are with young. What a magnificent expression of tenderness. The same arm that is powerful and mighty and great is the same arm that cradles and protects and succors the young in the flock. An important lesson to learn. We're not there for self-serving, for status, or for ego. We're there as shepherds to assist and to care. So let's come back to Exodus chapter 3. 40 years to learn that lesson, a lifetime's experiences to understand that, but in the end, the message got through. Now, in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1, he's at the mountain of God, and we made the point the other day that Jethro was a priest of God, his offerings were acceptable, and even the place of worship was called the mountain of God. It's outside of Israel, outside of tabernacles, outside of Egypt, there in the desert. And in verse 2, the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. Verse 4, when Yahweh saw he turned aside, God said unto him, and so on. So there's a principle here which the chapter is going to enlighten us in. You see, the angel of Yahweh is equated with Yahweh. They're the same person, the same individual, but called the angel in verse 2 and called Yahweh in verse 4, because we're going to introduce a chapter about manifestation, about ways in which God reveals himself. And we'll come to that later on in our address this evening. This is the first time an angel has appeared to Moses in his life. is 80 years old. A flame of fire in a tree in a desert. Back in the garden was a magnificent garden called the Paradise of God. And in that garden was a flaming fire keeping the way of the tree of life. And now look how things had changed. No longer is the garden there, it is in fact a desert. But nevertheless, the flaming fire in the midst of that bush links us back to the purpose of the cherubim in Genesis chapter 3. An angel and fire is the cherubic figure in Genesis. So the way to the tree of life is now about to be reopened for Israel. God maketh his angels spirits, says Psalm 104 verse 4, his ministers a flaming fire. Now, that word bush there is in the Hebrew thorn bush. You can go to Sinai today and you'll see the thorn bush. I'm being sarcastic. There's a monastery down there and the monks say this is the bush which Moses saw, but not really. It's a thorn bush. Thorns. That takes us back to Genesis as well, doesn't it? Thorns and thistles. This is the curse. So here we have the cherubic figure keeping the way of life in a flaming fire, but this time there's no garden, it's desert, and with thorns and thistles. How things have changed. But the way of God is still open. It's still open. Now, what's the point? Let's come to Malachi, shall we? The bush was not consumed. What's this saying? Malachi chapter 3. Verse 6, I am Yahweh, I change not, therefore ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. That thorn bush represented the state of the nation in the sight of God. Full of thorns, no fruitfulness, but God was still prepared to work with that people. I am Yahweh, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed. Now when we come to Deuteronomy chapter 33, this thorn bush appears again. Deuteronomy 33. It's the blessing of Joseph in verse 13 of Deuteronomy 33. These are the blessings of Moses. Verse 13, blessed of Yahweh be Joseph's land, precious things of heaven, for the dew, for the deep that coucheth beneath, for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, the precious things put forth by the moon, the chief things of the ancient mountains, the precious things of the lasting hills. Here is fertility, bounty, fruitfulness in every direction. This is Joseph's blessing. Verse 16, and for the precious things of the earth and the fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the thorn bush. Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph, upon the top of the head of him that was separate from his brethren. Now here's an interesting reference. All of this fruitfulness was due, in verse 16, to the goodwill, the mercy, the undeserved mercy, of him that inhabited the thorn bush. So many, many, many years later, in fact 40 years later, at the end of his life, Moses contemplated this appearance of the angel in the thorn bush. And 40 years later, he understood that the motive behind this appearance was the goodwill, the mercy, the undeserved favor of God who dwelt in that thorn bush for the express purpose of giving fruitfulness in the land. Not thorns, not thistles, but fruitfulness. And at the time, when he was looking at that apparition, not fully understanding what an angel was doing in the thorn bush. 40 years later, he understood that that was a tremendous sense of undeserved favor, that God should choose thorn bushes, sons of Jacob, corrupt, idolatrous people, and produce fruit out of those people. Let's come back to Exodus chapter 3. Moses looked, says verse 2, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And that's why we went to Malachi chapter 3. I am Yahweh, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed. That thorn bush represented the sons of Jacob. Shriveled, thorn-like, but eventually God was going to produce fruit out of that thorn bush. Not consumed. And Moses said in verse 3, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. He's talking to himself. When you're in the desert looking after sheep for 40 years, you end up talking to yourself. I think there's more in the record than that. I think what it's saying is that this is a contemplative Moses. This is a Moses who's reflecting and debating within himself. He was used to isolation and loneliness. I will turn aside. Okay, now there's a significance behind that word. I will turn aside. So what is the record saying? Moses is walking in a certain direction, and now he turns aside. What's that saying? He's turning into a different path. He's going along a different pathway. He's approaching the way leading to the bush. The way of the tree of life is now being opened before him, and he's turning onto that way. See what the record's saying? A simple change of direction has a spiritual significance. And when Yahweh saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. He said, here am I. Why is there the double name? Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. Can anyone think of another occasion when double names are used and the response comes back, here am I?
Samuel,
here am I. What else?
Peter.
Sorry?
Peter. Simon.
Who?
Martha.
It's the accent. Martha. Okay. How about this one? In Genesis chapter 46. There's Abraham in Genesis 22, but I want to go to Genesis 46. Saul. It's a little theme. It'd be worthwhile, you want to chase that down for a study one day. The double names. Is there a connection through there? Well, here's one of them. Genesis 46. Just about to go into Egypt. Verse 1, Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. He said, here am I. There it is. Jacob, here am I. He said, I am the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt. I will also surely bring thee up again. Isn't that interesting? He's going into Egypt. Jacob, here am I. Jacob, I'm going with you, and I'll surely bring you out. Moses, here am I, and here God is about to bring them out. Isn't that wonderful? I love those kind of points. Just that little connection, just with a double name. The God of the Father had appeared to him again. Nathaniel.
Eli.
Hey, get your concordance out and go. So here we are. Moses has turned aside. So he's now walking towards the tree along a different path than he was walking to before. And God says, stop. Verse 5. Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Stop. Now, he's drawing nigh, and he's stopped. Why is that? Well, 40 years before, Moses was full of his own leadership, his own sense of self. I'm coming to deliver you. Why don't you understand how God, by my hand, will deliver you? And he becomes the center of all of that. Who made thee a ruler and judge over us? No one had. And so 40 years later, he's approaching the tree and God says, stop, hold on, stop. Moses, you've got to learn that there is a holiness about what I'm about to do with you. The land which you're standing on is holy ground. Not like the churches believe in consecrated ground, nothing like that at all. The word holy means separate, in a desert, in the sand, holy ground. Stop. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet. Now, what does that represent? Well, we're talking about walking, we're talking about sandals, we're talking about in the way. Remove your sandals. Change direction, you have, good, but now just stop and contemplate. Now, where's another incident where someone had to remove their shoes because of holy ground? Let's come to that, shall we? Joshua chapter 5. And we'll see, I think, the significance of that. Joshua chapter 5 and verse 13. It came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with a sword drawn in his hand. So we have an angel with a sword. This is the cherubic figure again. And said to Joshua, and Joshua, art thou for us or for adversaries? I mean, Joshua's ready to defend it. He said, nay, but as the captain of the host of Yahweh am I now come. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, what saith my Lord unto his servant? And the captain of Yahweh's host said to Joshua, loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so. And the incident stops there. So why does the incident stop there? We're not told of the conversation that happened between the angel and Joshua. But the point of the record is that Joshua is looking at Jericho, debating as the best military strategy to take this city, and his thoughts are interrupted by the angel of God with a sword. And the clear implication is that the angel is saying to Joshua, Joshua, we're going to do it my way. Loose thy shoes from off thy feet. That's the last thing you do as a military officer, is to have bare feet. Shoes on the feet mean you're ready to run, ready to fight. Take them off. And whilst no conversation is recorded there, the clear implication is that the angel of Yahweh is going to be involved in the capture of the land. So when we come back to Exodus chapter 3, I think exactly the same lesson is being taught. The shoes of Moses, which had walked for 40 years in a desert, and before that had walked 40 years in Egypt, removed. We're going to do it my way, says God, not your way. I think that's the lesson behind that. Moses had to learn, stop. There's a holiness about the work we're doing, Moses, not your way. And put off your shoes, because we're going to do it my way, my direction. I think that's the lesson behind that. Verse 6, God says, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Let's just look at this for a moment. I am the God of thy fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. The word God is the Hebrew word Elohim, which can be translated as mighty ones. So in the Hebrew, what the angel is saying, and he's speaking as Yahweh, because he represents the Father in heaven, I am the mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. What does that mean? Whenever God appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. It was through the Elohim, through the angels, through the mighty ones. And now God is saying to Moses that I am the power behind those Elohim. You are looking at me as the representative of God. You are looking at me as the source and direction of all those Elohim that appeared to your fathers. I am. It's present tense. Present tense. We'll come back to that point in a moment. But just remember, present tense. I am the mighty ones of thy fathers. Now look at Moses' reaction. There is no one else in the record who, when confronted with an angel, hides his face. It is a unique reaction in the scriptures. Fear. So here we have another link to Genesis. The thorns, the fire, the way, and Moses hiding his face. That's exactly what Adam did when he was confronted by God for his iniquity and sin. He hid his face. Now, how different is this man to 40 years before? The boldness, the confidence has all gone. And 40 years of deep contemplation, looking at his failure, have made this change. Huge. But we're going to find out in a minute, it went too far. We'll see that in chapter 4. Humility is important. Fear is not the right reaction for him to have. Fear is an expression of guilt. That's how he felt. And God had to now encourage this man to change this. Well, God says to him, verse 7, I've surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, have heard the cry by reason of their taskmasters, I know their sorrow. You know, God was absent for 40 years, but he was not unaware of the tragedy that was happening. Just because God doesn't intervene doesn't mean to say he's not aware of the issues. He was vitally aware. And verse 8 he says, I am come down to deliver them. Now that expression, I am come down, is an expression of manifestation. Does anyone know where else that expression is used, of God coming down? Tower of Babel, where else? Mount Sinai, he came down upon Mount Sinai, where else? Well, there's another little theme to chase through. The coming down of God to inspect, to intervene, to care for it. It's quite a little theme, the coming down of God. I'm come down. Now look at verse 11. And Moses said to God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? What a dramatic change. Who am I that I should go up? How different he was. And sometimes, brethren and sisters, there we go again. Sometimes, brethren, the point is that the experiences of life are sometimes the only things that change us. And you've got to believe that God is behind life's experiences and trials and triumphs, changing very slowly and imperceptibly our attitudes and our values. Trial, difficulty, and experience do that. And God has this very skillful way. Paul put it this way, all things work together for good for those who fear and love him. In other words, an incident here and an incident there, an incident over there, all together, very skillfully put together, work together for good. And look at the change that happened here. Who am I that I should go? David asked that question. Jeremiah asked that question. And in the end, in the ecclesial life, you get to the situation where you think, well, yeah, who am I? Who are we? Out of the millions of people that have been called on the earth, we have been called in the goodness of God. But who are we? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. But Moses had just gone that extra step in which he lost all confidence, and God had to sort of bring him back into service. Immediately God says in verse 12, certainly I will be with thee. Now why would he say that? He would only say that if he detected in Moses this sense of helplessness and powerlessness. So immediately God responds in verse 12, certainly I will be with thee. That's only relevant if he thought Moses knew he needed help. What a change. I will be with thee. And this shall be a token unto thee that I've sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. It'll be a sign. You'll be back here, Moses, and that'll be the sign that I am with you. Then Moses asked that question. If Israel says to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? They had forgotten God's name. So now we're going to explain this name, because it's a fascinating little section of scripture, and it helps us understand this principle of what the meaning of the name is all about. Israel today don't use the name. They have this superstitious fear of using it. They use anything except Yahweh. They use the name, the Almighty, the Blessed. They will not use the Yahweh name. But God revealed this to Moses, so we need to understand it. So verse 14, God said to Moses, I am that I am. Now, you're probably aware that consists of two words or three words in the Hebrew, Ayah, Asher, Ayah. And unfortunately, the authorized version's got it wrong. It's not I am who I am, it's I will be whomsoever I will be. Now, in the previous verses, he said, I am, present tense, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. He's now going to use the future tense, I will be. So there's a change, a subtle change, but a change nevertheless. I will be whom I will be. This is his name. So immediately the question comes, he'll be what? So verse 15, we have the explanation of that. And God said moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, the Elohim of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. So verse 16 is the exposition of verse 15. Sorry, Nathan?
Do you mean verse 15 is the exposition?
Sorry, verse 15 is the exposition of verse 14. Thank you. Yes, sorry about that. Okay, step by step. Ayah is I will be. Yahweh is he who will be. Okay, we've gone from I, first person, to he, third person. But Ayah and Yahweh, similar Hebrew roots. One is first person, I will be. Yahweh is he will be. So the explanation, I will become whom I will become, is explained in verse 15, he will become Elohim. Mighty ones. He will become mighty ones. Now, in the previous verse, he said, I am mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At the moment, in the present tense, I work through the existing mighty ones. I am the mighty ones who are associated with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it is my intention, it is my purpose in the future to become another group of Elohim, another group of mighty ones. And these mighty ones are also associated with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, the Elohim of Israel. So this concept of I will become somebody is explained as God becoming mighty ones associated with Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Now, who are these mighty ones associated with the fathers? They are the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's God's purpose to develop out of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob mighty men and women of faith. They are the seed of Abraham, the seed of Isaac, the seed of Jacob, because God is a father. That's why Israel was called as a son. Now, any questions so far? Because I'll go to the next stage in a minute. Does that make sense? At the moment, I am mighty ones. The angels themselves are looking after all of the seed, but it's my purpose to become another group of Elohim, another group of mighty ones. All right, any questions? Does that make sense? Let's prove this from the New Testament. Because this was quoted, Exodus chapter 3 was quoted by Jesus Christ in Luke chapter 20. Let's come there. And this confirms the exposition. And it's the question of the resurrection of the dead. You know the story? The Sadducees appear on the scene with this question. You know, this was the unanswerable question. No one can ever answer this question. The Sadducees didn't believe in angels and they didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And they said, verse 28, Master, Moses wrote unto us, if any man's brother die having a wife and he die without children. And we know the story is, husband died and she went through all of these husbands. Therefore, in verse 33, in the resurrection, whose wife of them is she? For seven had it a wife. Ha ha, we've got you. Verse 34, Jesus said, the children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. So the relationship of those who are made immortal in the kingdom will be so close and so wonderful in fellowship that marriage, in fact, will just disappear. There'll be a closeness amongst all these people. Marriage is no longer required. Now, verse 36. Neither can they die anymore, for they are equal unto the angels. They are the children of God and the children of the resurrection. So, he's going to make 3 points. Equal to the Elohim, because angels are Elohim, sons of God, and sons of the resurrection. Now, how on earth is he going to prove those points? And he's only permitted to use the first 5 books of the Bible because that's all the Sadducees believed in. So let's look at his argument. Verse 37. Now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush, when he calleth the Lord, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And if you have a marginal reference, you'll see there, that's a quotation from Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6. That's this verse here. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. I am. And his argument is in verse 38, he is not a God of the dead, but of the living, for all live unto him. So his point is that if God is surnaming himself with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then quite clearly in the mind of God, these people can't be dead. Because would God associate himself with dead people? Answer, no. So that proves that God will raise Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Because God will not surname himself. He will not be the mighty ones of dead people. And by the way, the Sadducees don't believe in angels, but Exodus chapter 3 says, and the angel of Yahweh appeared unto Moses. So that's a double hit. Now, how's he going to prove that people are equal to the angels and are the sons of God? The only way he can prove that from that context is by the expression Yahweh Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. So you see, when it says there, he calleth the Lord the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, he wasn't just quoting verse 6, he was also quoting verse 15. What does verse 15 prove? God will one day become mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. And these mighty ones are the saints in glory, and because the word Elohim is used, they are equal to the angels. And because they are of Abraham, they are the seed of Abraham. They are sons of resurrection and sons of God. So I believe, brothers and sisters, that the exposition of Exodus 3, he'll become mighty ones of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is in fact confirmed by the Lord's exposition. Verse 6, I am Elohim. God is never associated with dead people. Verse 15, I will become another group of Elohim. And Elohim in verse 15 and Elohim in verse 6 mean that the Elohim of the future will be equal to the angels now. All right, questions and comments? Have I lost you, or does that make sense? Okay, that's neither yes or no. To me, I think the Lord's exposition is brilliant because it confirms the exposition of the context. God's intention to become a future race of Elohim. If he's got an existing race of Elohim, then the new race of Elohim must be equal because they bear the same name, Elohim, mighty ones, equal to the angels. And we know the angels aren't married, and we know the angels don't sin. Daniel.
Well, I was like, the prayer that...
Oh, sorry.
You keep calling my name.
What's your name tag, sir? Joseph.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was like the prayer that Jesus gave before he was crucified, where he says that the prayer about that they may be in one, or one as me and you are one.
Yes.
You know, that I've used that before to try to show not just manifestation, but the name also.
Okay.
Will be in whom you are.
John 17, I have declared thy name unto my brethren, that we may be one as thou art one. Same concept. Yep. God manifests in people who are like him, and they are one, yet they're individuals. It's a glorious concept. Okay, let's come back to Exodus 4. We have a long dialogue between the angel and Moses. Moses is told that he is going to deliver Israel. And we learn in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 10, Moses refuses. In verse 10 of Exodus 4, Moses said to Yahweh, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. Where was the quotation that said that Moses was mighty in word and deed? Acts 7 verse? Positive?
Acts 7 verse 22.
You're right, you were positive. Let's write Acts 7:22 against that verse, because it is an absolute contrast. In Egypt, he was mighty in word and deed. And now he says, I can't even speak. I am slow of speech. I am not eloquent. As the margin says, a man of words. What has happened here? How 40 years has changed this individual?
I think it's his confidence level or is it his ability?
What do you reckon?
I think it's confidence.
Okay. How does the group feel about that? Let's throw that question back to the group. What do you think? What contributed to that? Is it confidence? Lack of confidence? Jimmy.
I think after 40 years of not doing something, you might get a little rusty.
The sheep don't talk back, you mean? Yeah? But whatever, we have a vastly different man. The Hebrew is, I am heavy of mouth and heavy of tongue. All that rashness, all that impetuosity has gone. Now, the man's gone too far. And the great lesson about this is that if we have capacity and we have abilities, either in expounding the Word of God or shepherding and caring or understanding the things of God, if we have a capacity to do that, we're going to see here that we can't excuse ourselves from that work like Moses did. It's all very well being humble. It's all very well being in a situation where we're undeserving, but here we've gone too far. So God responds, verse 12, now therefore go, I will be with thy mouth. I will be, how about that? That's Aya, I will become thy mouth and teach thee what thou shalt say. So Moses objects again, verse 13, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. Don't send me, send someone else. Verse 14, the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite thy brother? I know that he can speak well. And also, behold, he cometh forth to meet thee. When he seeth thee, he'll be glad in heart. And thou shalt speak unto him, and put words in his mouth. And I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what ye shall do. So every time Moses comes back with an objection, God meets the objection. Oh, said Aaron. Oh, by the way, Aaron's on his way down. God had foreseen every one of those objections. You know, young people, it really is critical that if we do have the capacity that God has given us, that we use that capacity in his service. You can't excuse yourselves because you don't feel like it. Or like Moses, you make excuses, oh, I can't speak, I can't study. If you have the capacity, you've got to use it. The anger of Yahweh was kindled because every excuse in the book, as it were, was thrown back at God. In the end, God says, I will teach you. In the end, God says, I will teach you. In the end, the Word of God teaches us. And if we have that capacity and we have that capability and opportunity, seize it and use it to the glory of God. But don't make excuses. It's like the man who hid his talent in the earth. Though the word talent means money, it still has the idea, doesn't it, of a talent, a capacity, if you like, different capacities. Hiding it in the ground is what Moses was doing. Humility is great, but to make excuses is not so great. Now, we're going to leave Moses here in this study. We're going to have a 15-minute break, and then we'll have our final study tonight on Exodus 17. So let's come back in 15 minutes' time. Thanks.